situation.
Well, Paratopia, you've just heard our brand spanking new theme song that, well, Jeff actually premiered it in an episode with Dr. David Clark, but we're now adopting it for this show, and, drumroll please, awesome, our new show, Paratopia Live, Sundays at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. That's right, we have a new show.
That's right, live. That's right.
Yes, live. Ooh, scary. So Sundays at 9 p.m. Eastern Time at the ParaQuest Radio Network, which is ParaQuestRadioNetwork.com. You can listen to Paratopia Live. You can call in. You can utilize the chat room, and maybe we'll take questions from there. Yeah. And it will basically be, you know, sort of an extension of the previous Friday's show. So we're starting this Sunday. So we'll be talking primarily about this week's episode.
Yeah.
And hopefully be talking with you about it or whatever you'd like to talk to us about. Don't be shy. Feel free to call in. This is something we've been working on for a while. We finally found a happy home for it. And this is going to be exciting.
Yeah, I'm very, very excited. So, do we want to give the call-in number now?
Sure. That number is 1-801-251-1045. That number again, 1-801-251-1045. And, of course, that phone number will also be in the chat. So you can, if you didn't jot it down now, you can get it then. Don't start calling now. This isn't like, you know, when Apple releases a new iPod and you have to wait in line for a couple of days. You know, like you can wait till Sunday right. And then call us.
Right.
Yeah.
So give us a call on the happy party line.
We're going to start doing kooky radio noises.
Whatever that was. Yeah. Yes.
That was my clown horn.
Okay.
Well, anything else we'd like to say about this before we get on with the show?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Join us on Sunday.
Yes, each and every Sunday. And we haven't decided really if we're going to start archiving all the episodes, a best of thing, or none of the episodes. We're really tempted to just not have an archive so that you're forced to tune in live. And if you miss it, you miss it.
Right.
And we'll probably do that. So you don't want to miss it.
But 9 p.m. Eastern, correctly?
Correctly.
Right.
Oakley dokely.
It's 1:07 a.m.
That's right. All right. As we were saying, if we can get serious for a moment here, on with the show.
If you record audio for any purpose, chances are you want it to be heard. You want to attract the largest audience possible who can hear your message. That's where we come in. We're CyberEars.com, a revolutionary internet service that will host your audio files and help you promote and track its popularity. Considering hosting a podcast to the world? We have all the automated tools to make the process as simple and easy as it can be. No technical mumbo-jumbo to work out. CyberEars.com does all the work for you. You record it. We take care of the rest. So don't delay. Go to CyberEars.com today and register for a free trial account. Upload your audio files and get heard. With CyberEars.com, it's your audio on your terms.
Jeff Ritzman, another fine episode of Paratopia lays before us.
Like a fine wine waiting to be uncorked.
Yes. Or like right. A beauty on the Titanic waiting to be painted before the whole ship goes down. Wait, what?
What?
I don't know. But Jeff, what are we doing here? I thought you have no love for the Roswell, and it's too old to know anything about anymore, and yet you said, hey, Jer, let's do a Roswell show.
Well, because it seems pertinent to do one. We are, after all, predominantly a ufological geared show, right? When we're not delving into drugs and ghosts.
Right.
yeah, well, I mean, this story just kind of not too long ago popped up. A man by the name of Frank Kimmler teaches high school level earth science and geology at New Mexico Military Institute in Roswell. And this man has gone out in search of debris from the original crash site and has found some unusual stuff. And I came across this on, I believe it was, UFO Updates. I was reading there one day and I saw this and followed it to openminds.tv. And there's the story. And you can see this. We'll have a link up to openminds.tv. And this seems to be where most of his data went. I would ignore the headline, which is "Test Confirms Roswell Debris Is Not From Earth."
I was just going to say that. Yeah, if you ignore the headline, yeah, you're fine.
As Mr. Kimmler will tell us, they took a little bit of liberties with that headline. So, but nonetheless, it's an interesting story, and he seems like a straight up guy. And so, what else do we have to talk about in the beginning of the show? That's coming up, but what do we got for right now?
I don't know. Do we have to have anything for right now? I could just fill in time with one of my funny bits. The kids love that. Hello?
Anyway, without further ado,
right?
Here's Frank Kimmler. Paratopia, please make welcome Mr. Frank Kimmler. Frank, thank you for coming on the show tonight.
It's my pleasure to be on your show. I was looking forward to it.
And Frank, you're here for a very auspicious occasion. This is our first show we've ever talked about Roswell on. Normally, that's
the first.
Yeah, that's an unusual thing for this show. And in the past, I've said, you know, we need to kind of move on from Roswell. We need to realize that it's almost too far gone to really get any useful data out of. But you have come across some interesting things. But first, before we get to that, I'm reading here on your bio that you had a UFO sighting back in your 20s.
Yeah, that
can you
was
tell us about that?
That was an interesting little experience. I was traveling cross country with when I was fresh out of college. I just had got my bachelor's degree, and I borrowed my dad's van. I said, "Hey, can I use the van?" He says, "Sure." He says, "What are you going to do?" I says, "I'm going to take a cross country trip." So a friend of mine from college by the name of Bob Visconti, we were traveling cross country in the van. We stopped at a place called Ute Lake State Park. I think it's up by Tucumcari, New Mexico. And we were camped out, and it was, I don't know, it was probably 11 o'clock at night, 10, 11 o'clock at night, I guess. And Bob says, "Hey, look at the neat thing up in the sky." And I'm watching this little, it looked like a satellite. You know, you see the little stars that kind of drove, and everybody knows what satellites look like, and they just kind of travel across the sky. And I says, "Oh, it's a satellite, Bob." And he says, "No, watch what it does." And I stared at it for another, I don't know, maybe 30 seconds or so, and the thing made a perfect zigzag, just went back and forth, and then zipped across the horizon and disappeared. Mm. And I'm going, oh, I think maybe I've had one too many beers, but the scary part about that was I didn't have any beers yet. We just had parked and built the fire, so we hadn't fired up the beers yet. So that was the only explanation that I have for that thinking about it is that I don't know of anything that makes abrupt right-angle turns and zigzags back and forth and then zips across the sky faster than a speeding bullet. It wasn't a satellite. Satellites don't do that. And I would, other than that, that's really the only experience that I've had with anything that might be considered a UFO. And I certainly consider that being a UFO. Absolutely. I mean, it's not beyond a shadow of a doubt in my mind.
Did you always have an interest in UFOs, even from possibly an early age?
You know what? A little bit, yeah. I was always fascinated. I liked science fiction stuff, I had an interest in that because it was kind of fascinating. It kind of piqued my interest in, you know, the possibility of life on other worlds and things like that. That's always been a it's been kind of a fascination. I mean, you know, I don't have models of UFOs in my house or pictures of any of any UFOs hanging right. on the walls or anything like that. But yeah, you know, it's of interest to me. You know, I read the reports and I look at things and it's absolutely fascinating topic actually.
Yeah. Well, you teach earth science and geology at New Mexico Military Institute in Roswell.
That is correct. I've been here for about 2 years. So I teach earth science on the high school side, and I teach geology, physical geology, as well as historical geology, which is dealing with life and fossils and things like that, and how it all got started on Earth. So I do that on the college side. So it's a pretty it's a good course. I get lots of my classes are packed full, so they like me as a teacher, and that says something right there. I think when the classes fill up.
Yeah, nice. So when you moved to Roswell, that is when you started poking around in, I guess, the aspect of finding some kind of tangible proof of the Roswell incident. Am I right?
Actually, well, when I first moved here, I didn't really think that much about it. I mean, I knew about the Roswell thing, and we moved here at the end of July, and we just had missed the Roswell Festival, and it was many, many months before I even visited the International UFO Museum. You know, I had people say, well, you know, it's probably not worth going to visit, things like that. I didn't give that much thought to it. And then a very strange thing happened, because at my work, I ended up meeting some people that were like friends and relatives, and they knew all about the Roswell thing. And kind of like maybe at lunchtime or whatever, I'd ask them some questions in reference to it. And I says, you know, there must be something to this. So I went down to the UFO museum, and I went to the museum. And I says, well, this is kind of a neat thing. And then I got to thinking. I got to reading. I read a lot of the books, many of them, almost all of them. And then I went into the International UFO Museum. Their extensive. They've got a nice research library. It's like for UFOs. They claim it's the second largest researched library in the world, second only to the Vatican when it comes to UFOs. And I might believe that because it's like endless. I keep finding new things in there all the time. So I, read a bunch of stuff, and I'm going, well, nothing has been. There hasn't been any real physical evidence. There's hundreds of testimonies and lots of eyewitness accounts and everything, but there's not any real tangible physical evidence. And you know what? People need to see and touch something or have something land on the White House lawn or something before they're going to believe this stuff. So that kind of piqued my interest. So I wanted to put my scientific knowledge to work to see if I might be able to find something that nobody else has ever found before. And that's kind of how I got started on this.
Can I ask you, just as an aside, what is the like when you talk to people in town, or I mean, you've lived there long enough to have made friends and probably just had casual acquaintances in town. What is the general, I don't know, like the social climate in Roswell as far as the Roswell incident goes? Are people disgusted with it? Do they embrace it there? What do you think that the general consensus is about this whole thing? Are they aggravated with it?
Not really. If you, it's kind of an interesting thing. Some people, well, the people who have lived here for a long time, they get tired of it. I mean, seriously, if you run into them, they say, oh yeah, the Roswell thing. We know the story. We're tired of hearing about it, kind of thing. But then there's the people that have the businesses downtown that some of them that are like UFO related, the tourist side of it. The tourist side about it, and I would have to say that the political side of Roswell, they kind of embrace it a lot, simply because it brings in a lot of keeping the story going, and having the UFO museum here brings in quite a bit of revenue for the city.
Sure.
The museum gets thousands of stuff. So you get that group of people, and then there's a group of people that are friends and relatives of the people that experience this, and they'll talk about it. Some are a little secretive. Others will freely talk about the thing. So, maybe a 50-50 toss-up in town as to those.
Really?
And then some people really don't care, but gosh, it's everybody that lives here seems to know about it in one way or another.
Yeah, that sounds just about like every other, you know, hotspot for UFO things that I've heard about or went to. You find half the people think it's neat and are interested in it and will talk to you about what they've experienced there, here or there, in regard to whatever. And the other half don't want anything to do with it. So that doesn't seem that unusual.
That's very true, and that seems to be about the case here as well.
Yeah. So when you got into this and said, I'm going to try and find something, what was your first step?
Well, the very first step was, since I only knew a little bit about the Roswell event, was that I essentially went down to the International UFO Museum. I read every single book that they had, the ones by Don Schmidt, Tom Carey, Kevin Randall. I read the pros. I read the cons on it. Flock's stuff, I think that's his name, Stanton Friedman's material. You know, all of these people are good researchers. And then, of course, I talked to the staff there and researched a bunch of the videos that were there, documentaries and stuff. And then the next step was trying to figure out where the crash site was. And then, of course, I went out on the Internet, and that helped a little bit, but not much. And the staff wouldn't tell me where it was, but, you know, being a geologist and knowing the lay of the land pretty good, and I was pretty good with satellite imagery and stuff, and, you know, reading about it, and it didn't take me long to figure out the exact location. And once I did that, then it was a matter of looking at the terrain to see how the terrain was laid out. The things that I kept in my mind was, number one, the types of material. It was lightweight. Was it lightweight? Was it heavy? You know, I went by the discussions of what was the eyewitnesses reported. So it was very lightweight material. You know, they said it was kind of flowing around in the wind and blowing all over the place, and so it wasn't real heavy, so it would stay close to the surface. And so I looked at the hydrology, which is the way the water flows out there. I looked at the lay of the land, the hills, the runoff. I looked at the types of soils that were out there and the reaction to certain types of metals. I studied all kinds of things at this. Then I looked at the previous work that had been done from an archaeological side of it. I know the University of New Mexico Office of Contract Archaeology, they did some work with the Sci-Fi Channel out there. I looked at the types of equipment they were using. They dug holes. They used quarter-inch mesh screens, and they used basically metal detectors that couldn't find anything less than maybe an inch across. The screens could find quarter-inch stuff, but you're limited to what basically falls through the screen or gets captured in the screen. Anything larger than a quarter of an inch. CUFOS back in the 1980s, the Center for UFO Studies, they also did they punched 200 holes out there where the site was. In fact, I found a lot of these old holes out there, so I knew it was in the right place. They also used metal detectors that had search heads on them that were much too large, and they didn't spend, they looked in good places based upon what I read, but they probably didn't have a good knowledge of the equipment or whatever, but speaking to them, they didn't find anything. I've got a metal detector that can, and I'm really good at using it. I've used it for many, many years to find gold nuggets with. It can find a gold nugget the size of a BB down to about 3 inches,
okay,
under perfect conditions. And, you know, armed with doing some research and some old aerial photographs and looking at it, I sort of plotted and planned and went out there and my son came with me, and I used the metal detector, and I was out there probably for a good 5 hours, if not longer, and I didn't find a thing. And that's a long time to be swinging a metal detector and not finding anything. The area is really pristine. My son thought it was nuts. He says, Dad, are you crazy? He says, you've been listening to the hum of that metal detector all day. You haven't found anything. Why don't you just give up and go home? I says, no, I'm not going to give up. And that's I'm kind of tenacious when it comes to to finding things. I mean, I will eventually give up, but it's a slim chance, and it doesn't happen very often that I do give up. Just before we got ready to leave for the day, after I think it was about 6 hours of metal detecting that I was out there, I got this little ping, and it was in an anthill. I actually, just before that, I had found a boot tack that was about an inch down, and that sort of got the adrenaline going a little bit and pushed me a little bit. And about maybe 40 minutes or 50 minutes after I found the boot tack, then I got this little ping that was different. You can tell in a metal detector the sounds that you get, the difference between iron and aluminum and gold. You can actually tell. And this didn't sound like iron. It sounded something different. So I got pretty excited, and I dug it up, and I held this little piece of shiny stuff that looked exactly like a piece of aluminum in my hand. I'm going, oh, my gosh, what have I found here? And then, of course, it was racing through my head. I'm going, is this a piece of an alien spacecraft, or, you know, is it a piece of trash? But there's no trash out there. That's the issue. There's the area is pretty pristine, and you just don't find any. It's not a place that people camp out or whatever. You know, you might get some hunters, up there once in a while, but there's not. There's very, very little trash material that you would find in areas where there's lots of people. It's just not there.
How far off a road would we be talking about, I mean, in this area?
It is, I'm just thinking here that the road is just about, the dirt road is about 2 miles away.
Wow,
I remember on that. So it's 2 miles off the road. There is a windmill. It's about a mile away, the windmill's been there since prior to like the crash site. The windmill's mentioned. It shows up in the documentaries. It's mentioned, and so the windmill's out there, and you can see it from the location. So that's been there for a while. But other than that, the area is clean. The only thing that's out there is a few cows, and they're few and far between too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you said something about an anthill. Now, you had figured, I guess, ahead of time that if there was anything left, it would be very small, and it would likely be in an animal burrow or an anthill. Why is that? Can you explain that?
I wanted to narrow my search down a little bit, and I tried very hard to focus on the anthills and the animal burrows, because if something was buried just a little bit down, the critters would kick it up, and they're pretty good. They would, you know, their ants are really good about bringing stuff up to the surface, and so are the gophers and the rattlesnakes and everything else that digs little burrows and stuff. And they churn up a lot of ground, and I wanted to check those specifically first. So every time I saw an anthill during my searches, and every time I saw an animal burrow or some kind of disturbed ground, I zeroed in on that and searched it really, really good, because it's a common place to find things. Not the 1800s, but it's a common thing for rock hounds to look at anthills to find things like garnets and the peridots, which is the green things. And over in Africa, they found diamonds in anthills. So the best miners in the world are the critters, and why not use them to do some of the work for you to sort this stuff out?
Yeah.
And a lot of times they don't like, there's certain things they don't like. They don't like little pieces of metal. They just kind of kick it. Whatever they don't like, they kind of throw out.
Right.
And if it's edible, they'll eat it. If not, it goes out on their little dump, and they're good miners. And that's what I wanted to do, was check a lot of that stuff, and that's what I did, and I got lucky.
Okay. Well, you also found buttons, and I'm curious about these buttons because they look almost identical to a war bag that my dad gave to me. He was in Korea, and these buttons that I'm looking at, which are on openminds.tv, they look exactly pretty much like his buttons, except his have four holes. These have two. Have you had a chance to research those a little bit and find out if indeed they are from like a 40s fatigue type uniform?
I have gotten, first off, they might be trouser buttons. I've had a couple of button collectors basically come back and say they're trouser buttons. They couldn't tell. I've had a couple of people come back and say that they are military fatigue buttons. So they might be you know, trouser buttons from the fatigues or whatever. And then a very interesting thing happened. I was given a talk to the MUFON folks here, the state MUFON meeting, and I had a really old gentleman walk up to me that said that he was in the military, he was an officer in the military, and he said that the buttons are identical to the ones that he wore in the late 40s or early 50s when he was just a youngin in the military. And he says, they're military buttons, even though they're not marked or anything. And that sort of matched what other people had said, that they were, you know, from the late 40s, early 50s, and they were more than likely military buttons. I'm pretty well convinced that they are, in fact, military buttons. And that was a pretty exciting find. Two of them were found laying on the surface, just laying on the surface. And another one was found 2-3 inches deep in hard-packed clay. So that was an interesting find, and that one is, if you look at them, some of them are worn off on the edges a little bit, and there's another one that's really kind of sharp and crisp on the edges. That's the one that was buried. So I knew they were pretty old. They've been rattling around out there for a long time. And in my honest opinion, I think that is almost conclusive evidence that the military was out there. And that area where I found the buttons is probably, I don't know, maybe 100 yards, maybe 200 yards, about 200 yards away from where I found the metallic debris.
Is it possible? I mean, to me, I'm looking at those buttons and I'm thinking, if they are from the period in time where whatever landed, crashed, demolished itself in the desert, would they not make really great analytic control samples for doing analysis? In other words, could you run the same tests on the fragments that you found against the buttons and see how that compares?
Yes, you could. Actually, you could do that. And the buttons are certainly large enough, and I have three of them that you could use that as a kind of a foundation. Normally, when you do tests for things, you should always run, especially if you're doing technical isotope work, you should run a standard from Earth side by side with whatever you're running. The next test that we run on any of this material, there's going to be some standards that are run where we can compare it against Earth and then also the aluminum. But yeah, the buttons could be used that way. Absolutely, you could use that, and it would be much better to use a standard that's known from the National Institute of Standards, one that they know what's in it, and you run one of those side by side, and then it basically tells you whether you've got a perfect match or whether it's off otherworldly or something. That's good science.
Well, even if you, if you look at like kind of what the pharmaceutical companies do when they test a new drug, they'll give X amount of placebos to X amount of the actual drug to test subjects. And so, the other question here is it possible that you could take a terrestrial sample? Just say you got a Coke can and you burned the hell out of it and mashed it and whacked it with a sledgehammer so that it resembled remotely what you've got here in the Roswell samples. And then blind those before you give them to a lab so that you're holding essentially a code key that says what is what, and then see what difference comes up in each sample. Like, would one definitively come up as this is the top off a Coke can and versus this stuff, which shows some stuff that doesn't seem to be the typical? I mean, have you thought about a blind type of thing? Or does that get into more money at that point? I mean, that's the real question is that going to break you?
When you do those, they run about $1,000 a pop or $500 to $1,000 a pop to do those.
Right.
But that would be an ideal thing to basically take and do that type of science. I mean, that's actually like I said, labs actually do this. They don't run the blind things, but they run an internationally known standard side by side with what you're running, and basically it kind of does the same thing. And you can go out to like Alcoa, and you can get all these alloys. Like the top of a can is made out of a 5032 alloy, and the sides are made out of a 304 alloy. And you can actually order all these standards, and you can run them side by side with what, and it'll tell you whether it's a perfect match or not.
How many pieces of the metallic debris did you actually come across?
Well, it's been an ongoing effort because I go out there once in a great while and look around, and then I'll let it set for a few months, and then I'll go out and look around a little bit more, because it is, like I said, I was about to drive my son crazy walking around there, because you'll go out there and search most of the day and find nothing.
Right.
The total right now is up to about, I would have to say 16 fragments is,
okay.
I've got 16 pieces of material that have come from out there. The last bit of material I found just recently, it was on July 16th, I found, thanks to my son, Mr. Eagle Eye, he helped me find, it wasn't buried, it's just, he uses all the information, the data, the research that I've done, and he knows about it, and I've talked to him about it, and so he knows what the ground looks like, and he knows what the area, and he just has a feel for this, and I was really quite amazed. And when we pulled the truck out there, and he says, "Dad, we need to go look right over here because it matches the criteria that you have set up to look for this stuff." And that was probably the fastest find. Probably within 20 minutes, we had found one fragment, and I'm like, "This is amazing." And of course, it's all GPS located, and it's photographed just as it comes out of the ground. So
yeah, I was going to ask if you were doing kind of a, you know, a inlay of where everything was found, like exact spots.
Oh, yeah.
All that. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I've done that. That's it may not be perfect archaeology, but everything is photographed and everything is documented as it comes out. The only sad thing is about is the very first one was that I found the anthill one. I had my camera with me, but it was back in the car, so I didn't get a chance to photograph every section of pulling it out of the ground.
Right. Right.
But the other pieces I have, so and everything's marked with GPS, like I said, so I know exactly where all this material came from, and it helps me to plot and plan and figure out where other things might have, where other material might be as well. When you find multiple fragments scattered over a large area, it helps you kind of hone in on where other pieces might be.
And would you say everything that you've found so far has been smaller than a penny?
Yes. Yeah, everything has been really, really small. Some of it, there's a few pieces that may have been caught in a quarter-inch mesh. Other pieces would certainly probably fall through a quarter-inch mesh. Most of it's really tiny. But and it's just as I figured, most of it's on the surface. It's laying probably no more than a half inch down in the surface for most of it. It's there right on the top, which is right where I figured it would be because it's such lightweight material.
Right. Now, I know what you found is precious little, and that pretty much every sample that you have to you is a valuable thing to have in your hands. But we've heard about Roswell debris for a long, long time. And one of the things we always hear about it is you can't bend it. You can't burn it. I mean, this kind of stuff comes right from the late Marcel Sr., who said, you know, they would take a mall sledge to this stuff and bigger sheets, sure, than what you found. And this stuff won't bend. It won't break. It won't burn. Have you just any of these pieces that you've held in your hand, can you bend them with your fingers? Are they not bendable?
No, and this is a thing, and I've told everybody this because a lot of people that follow the Roswell story and stuff, they say, you know, if it doesn't match the descriptions, we don't want to look at it. We don't want to hear about it. That it's trash. And no, to answer your question, this stuff is relatively tough. When you try to unfold it, it's difficult to unfold because some of it's folded over 6 or 7 times, and I'm careful to try to unfold it, but I've actually broke a couple of needles trying to unfold this stuff, so it's relatively tough. It has no magical properties. It is not, you can unfold it. It doesn't fold back up. For its thinness, it seems to be relatively tough, but it's not any tougher than a lot of other types of aluminum alloy things that are out there. And if you go back and read the stories, and read lots of them, you'll find that, there were some comments made by the military folks and also the folks that are eyewitnesses, and sometimes their stories change a little bit. So you have to not read between the lines, but if you go out and read these and you're very careful about it, the things that you're reading, you'll notice that there was some material that had the memory foil properties to it. There was also some material that it didn't.
Right.
And I think it was Axon and a couple of other people that actually mentioned that in reference to it. And then I got to thinking about this as well, and I'm going, you know what, if they, meaning the extraterrestrials, if that's where this stuff came from, if this material, if it's a spacecraft, if it's anything like our spacecrafts, like the space shuttle, is built out of a multitude of alloys. There's alloys that make up the base part of it. There's alloys that make up the structures, and it's all slightly different. The double hull that the space shuttle is made out of has two different aluminum alloys. I think it's a 6066 on the inside and a 6070 on the outside or something. It's just the alloy designation. And then it's packed with Kevlar in the middle. They call it a wiffle shield. I looked at all this stuff because I was looking at all the different types of alloys that are out there on the planet and kind of thinking about this stuff in a lot of ways. So it is my honest belief that there could be a multitude of materials out there. They talked about the I-beams, too, that was out
right there.
But no magical properties that I'm aware of.
Now, as far as the site itself and as far as searching with a metal detector, I mean, I've got a couple metal detectors here, and I go out in places where, you know, it's fairly remote. You don't see a lot of people on some of the farms that I've gone to, just relic hunting, just for either Civil War stuff or even old farm equipment, that type of thing. A lot of these places haven't seen feet in 45, 50 years.
Oh, yeah.
And I got to be honest, you know, I find a lot of trash. Even still, I find a lot of trash. Out in Roswell, in this field, how many pop-tops are you coming across?
Zero.
Really?
Seriously. Okay. I mean, I'm being perfectly honest with you. Not a single pop-top out there. None.
No beer cans, no Pepsi cans, no nothing.
I found one new aluminum can approximately a third of a mile away up on the ridge.
Wow. Okay.
Seriously. And
wow.
It was laying right on the top of the ground that looks, and it was basically smashed flat. It was up on the top, and it looked like it wasn't a beer can, it was a soda pop can. It was a relatively new one.
Right.
Like it probably no more than a year or two old. It had been out there. But
just somebody sitting on the ridge and cracked one open, drank it, and slammed it down.
Probably so. And it was, like I said, it was a good distance away from where I was at. Seriously, with all the metal detecting that I have done in this one particular area, there's a hillside that's 500 or 600 feet away. Actually, maybe more. It might be 1,000 feet away from where I was at. Somebody basically, because it's not natural, somebody went out there and took nails. And this is like the if you've done metal detecting before, if you get into an area where people have been finding things, sometimes people get jealous and they will throw handfuls of nails out there, which basically screws the metal detector up.
Right.
And right around the base of a ridge, and it's right at a point that I wanted to look at, because it's an area that if this thing would have crashed where they said it crashed, or skipped across the ground, when it hit the ground, according to the physics of blast trajectories, it would have sprayed stuff all over the side of the hill. And that just so happens to be where all these dang nails are. And there's a bunch of them out there, and it kind of surrounds one side of the hill. So when I say a bunch of nails, I've looked around. I've probably found maybe 10 or 15, but they are scattered like randomly around the base of the hill, and goes all the way from the west side to the south, all the way around to about half of the east side.
Wow.
And I've run across that. And they're all the same nails, and it's not from a building. Somebody scattered them randomly up there. So I found that, and then I did find a little piece of tin, roofing tin, that was all rusty, that was also almost 1,000 feet from where this other material was, and a little piece of wire and a boot tack. And all in all, I bet I can very easily stick it all in one of those snack bags that it's
right.
Not even a sandwich bag. I could cram it all in there, and that constitutes probably a good maybe 20 hours or not even 20 hours, much longer than that, days of metal detecting.
Wow.
Over kind of a pretty wide area and specific, but I mean, I haven't covered every square inch of it, but close to it. So I would have to say that area, as far as trash is concerned, is darn near spotless. It
okay.
is clean.
Just so we try to like avoid maybe putting a nefarious plot to the nail thing, could that have been from a fence row that might have been there at some point in time? Or have you looked around and talked to people and said, you know, there never was a fence there or anything like that? Or do you genuinely think that somebody was out there just fooling around and spreading nails?
You know what? I looking at it, I know where the fence lines are. The fence lines have been there forever. The fence lines are a long way off, and this is in the middle, and there is no fence line there. So no fence lines, no evidence of any buildings or anything. I seriously believe that somebody tossed those out there. It's just my idea.
That's a pretty large expanse of nails. I mean,
it is, and the way that they're kind of spread out in the absolute perfect location that you would look if something crashed and blew up out there right on the side of this, but where it would spray stuff on the side of the hill, it's right where you would want to look with a metal detector.
Wow.
And that was a little irritating. Although right now I think my total count on nails is no more than maybe 10 or 10 or so, maybe less, it might be 9. There's like 9 or 10 nails, but just the way that they were distributed up there, I seriously believe that somebody put them there.
These look like new nails, or are they, you know?
It looks like they've been there probably. They're old enough to be really rusty. So,
okay.
And they're not galvanized nails because they are, and they're not old. They're not from like the 1920s or 30s or anything like that. I'd have to say that the nails are maybe less than 20 years old, I bet.
Okay. Well, as far as getting back to the materials now, the relatively unknown things that you found there, what was your next point after that? Did you take them to be analyzed somewhere?
Well, I took them over. Well, the very first thing I did was I took that one, I call it AH1, which stands for anthill fragment, and I took that piece down to the International UFO Museum here in Roswell, and I spoke to the director there, Julie Schuster. and very nice lady. And of course, when I spoke to her on the phone, she says, "Well, what do you want me to do?" And I says, "Well, I've got a piece of metal from the crash site." And then she asked me a couple of questions, and she says, "You know what? Don Schmidt's coming in, and I want you to talk to him. And he's like one of the major authors and researchers for the Roswell event. A lot of stories. I mean, a lot of books he's written." So about 2 days later, I went down there and I met them in the office there, and met Don Schmidt. And there was another gentleman there by the name of Jack Rodden. And if you look his name up, I think his dad was like a photographer or something. He had something to do with the Roswell event. Pretty old guy. Both of them very nice, and I showed them the metal, and they asked me a whole bunch of questions, and then they said, "Well, where exactly did it come from?" And I had a map with me, and I took the map out, and I says, "It came from right here." And they just smiled and says, "Well, you did your research, because you were right smack dab in the middle of the area." And I says, "I know, it took a lot of work to find it." And they looked at it, played with a little bit much, tossed around some ideas, and they said, "Well, we need to get this analyzed." So the museum fronted the money, and I had it analyzed the first time over at New Mexico Tech, and the analysis was done via a piece of equipment called a microprobe. And it's a pretty sophisticated piece of equipment, probably not the absolute best thing to be looking at metal alloys with, but it's a good piece of equipment. I know things cost $1 million, so it's and they use it to look at Mars rocks and meteorites and all kinds of artifacts with, and it can tell you what's in the material. And when I had it analyzed, it came back as being an aluminum, silicon, magnesium, manganese, copper alloy. And it had weight percents on it. So when I got this back, I'm going, "Well, this is great." So there's some websites you can go out. There's one called the Materials Web, Matt Webb, and you can go out to the Aluminum Association and pull down what's called the Teal Sheets, which has the registration, composition registrations for everything except all the secret alloys, but it has every aluminum alloy on the planet, all of them. And you can look up the percentages. So I punched in the numbers, and it came back as being some kind of a 6024, some kind of a 6000 series alloy of some kind. And I'm going, "Well, this is weird, because this is a foil, and a 6000 series alloy is usually not found as foil. It's used in the construction industry, used for bridges and buildings and airplanes and things like that." So I said, "Okay, I don't have enough data here." So I went up. I wanted to nip this in the bud. So I wanted to get some isotope work done on up at the University of New Mexico. So I went to the University of New Mexico. I went to the Institute of Meteoritics, and I went to their expert on isotopes. There actually met a couple of guys downstairs, a couple of scientists. I won't mention their names, but they took me up and introduced me to their isotope manager, and. When I met him, I says, "Well, I he didn't know where the material came from. I just says that I've got a piece of metal that I found out in the desert, and I says I'd like to get some isotopes done on it." And I told him which isotopes I wanted. And he came back and immediately said, he says, "The only reason why you want those specific isotopes because you suspect this material is not from Earth," is exactly what he said. Now, he didn't know that this stuff came from Roswell. And he says, "So, well, what's going on here?" And he used my first name. He says, "What's going on, Frank? What's the story behind this?" And I says, "Well, fine." I says, this may be part of the Roswell event." And he immediately said, "Well, that's a bunch of hooey, and I don't want to deal with this." And then the other scientist that was in the office says, "But what if it is?" And he almost got mad at him. He said, "No, you guys just go." So I'm walking down the hallway, and the other scientist that was with me is the manager of the microprobe facility. And he also does some work for NASA and on Mars meteorites, and he does a lot of really cool research. And he says, "Well, I can't give you isotopes on this, but I run the microprobe facility here." And he says, "I can get you some really good tight numbers on this. When do you want to do it?" So I said, and I says, "Well, how about tomorrow?" And he says, "Well, fine." So I came back tomorrow. I said, we sat there for 3 hours, and he ran the analysis himself. And I got back some really tight numbers that basically indicated that it was something called a very close to a what's called a 6070 alloy. also used for construction, not found as foil, and this stuff is foil. So I had all this data and with me, and I kind of flashed it around. I showed it to various people at not this year's, but the year before the UFO convention that was here, and I spoke to, you know, Stanton Friedman and Tom Carey and Don Schmidt, and I ran across a really nice gentleman by the name of Chuck Sikalski. He saw the data, and he says, well, I've got some contacts with Bigelow. So I'm going, okay, let's see if we can get Bigelow to look at this. And it took a long time to get it set up, but I drove over to Austin, Texas, and had a company outfit called Earth Tech that's run by Hal Putoff. Might recognize his name. And I had Hal Putoff, his lab people, look at it, and they analyzed it, and they says, oh, this is interesting material, and we need to get some isotope work done on it. So I said, okay, you guys get this all set up, and just let me know. And I packed up all of my stuff, and I didn't leave anything with them, and I drove home. And it was months before I got any response back from them, and they finally said, we don't want to look at this anymore because we think it's the top of an aluminum can. And I'm going, but wait a minute. I was there when your lab technician said that this stuff needs to be isotopically analyzed. And then I said, well, can you send me all of your data? So many, many weeks, probably 6 weeks went by, more than a month. They finally sent the data. It was in raw form from their X-ray fluorescence unit. And about drove me crazy because I had to decompile all this information and kind of figure it out. But all they succeeded in doing was matching up the data that I got from the university. They didn't have anything that would indicate that it was a can.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing at all. So I took all of that information over to the International UFO Museum. I showed it to them. I says, I'm tired of this. Let's get the private lab to look at this. And they said they'd front it. So that's when I sent it off to get the isotope work done, and it came back, should I say, a little odd. It's right at the edge of what's called the error factor, the error limit, but I had two of the isotopes that pushed the limit of the error factor right up to the edge. And that usually means that there's either two things. Either this material is not made on Earth, or there's an analytical error somewhere. Hmm. And that's as far as it's gone at the moment.
Wow. Well, for us dummies, can you explain an isotope, please?
Yeah, I can do that. Of course, we have elements that are out there. And when you the elements that we have are made up of, they've got protons, electrons, and neutrons that make up in the atom itself. And what happens with the isotope is an isotope has inside the nucleus. The nucleus has it has too many protons, and it's out of balance is what happens. And the stable ones are ones that are not radioactive, and the ones that are unstable, or should I say the unstable ones are the ones that are radioactive, and the stable ones are ones that stay around and don't decay. They don't give up any radiation. And so basically that defines an isotope. It's basically in the nucleus of an atom, the atom is not balanced. You have to have so many, you have to have an equal number of protons and electrons. Mother Nature loves to have things balanced, and if it's not balanced, she tries to balance them. So an isotope is nothing more than an element out of balance, basically is what it is.
Okay. Now, as far as Open Minds go, they've got it listed as, test confirms Roswell debris is not from Earth. So do you agree with that, or do you...
No, now, I need to explain that a little bit. There was, when I gave the information to Open Minds, they took lots of liberties. Not once did I say that the material was extraterrestrial in origin. What I said to those folks, and what I've said to everybody all along, is that I have got two things going on here. Either this material may not be from Earth, or there is analytical error. And the only way that we're going to be able to determine this is to have some additional work done that will basically either confirm or deny the work that was already done. If I get another, which is it's basically in the process of doing some negotiations with some labs and some people to get some more work done. If we get another test done or two, and each one of those tests come back with ratios that are off, then I can come out and say 100% this material is not from Earth. Right now, what I've got is something that sits on a 50-50 line. It is either analytical error from a lab, which I find it a little bit hard to believe because the lab that did the work is has multiple certifications, including an aerospace certification, and that's the reason why I picked them. They are a good lab. Not saying they can't make mistakes. And yes, I also know that when you plot this stuff up on a isotope graph, that the it is right at the edge of the margin of error, and I know that as well. However, when you get two isotopes that are that far off, there's something goofy going on, and that goofiness is an anomaly that needs to be looked at because if it's not analytical error, then we've got material from another world, and there's no other explanation for it.
Okay. Well, when you talk about isotope anomalies, I looked around on the net because I saw that come up actually in the Open Minds thing too. What I see on the net, and you correct me if I'm wrong because I'm certainly not in this field in this capacity, but it doesn't seem like they're really all that uncommon, an isotope anomaly. You know, if you just Google the keyword isotope anomalies, you'll see quite a lot of them. You get quite a lot of hits on that. And I don't necessarily see that as being that unusual, but are these that unusual that they need to be looked at closer to actually define what those anomalies are?
Actually, it's true, and we do get some anomalies, and let me explain that a little bit for isotopes. Let me give you an idea. The human body loves to it happens to like, and we're going to pick on magnesium here because it's an easy one to work with. The human body loves to work on there's three stable isotopes of magnesium. There's magnesium 24, 25, and 26. Well, it just so happens that the human body doesn't really like magnesium 26 very much. So when it uses magnesium, it has a tendency to kind of hone in on the lighter ones and use it. So our bones are ever so slightly enriched in the lighter magnesiums, and the heavier ones are depleted. We see that in seashells. When you look at the numbers, that's where the strike, yes, there's some anomalies, all right, but we're talking about 0.001% mm-hmm. error, and we're talking about like one one-thousandth, one ten-thousandth of a percent in error for these, which is almost nothing. And what happens is you get these you'll get these anomalies in seawater, you'll get them in rocks within the earth, but that the anomalies that you're looking at are so minute that it takes very, very specialized types of equipment to see this. The anomaly that I have is off by tenths of a percent, multiple tenths of a percent, and we're not talking about thousandths of a percent. That is a significant thing when you look at isotope ratios, because we can take isotope ratios from Earth. It is our fingerprint. If we pull some material from the moon, its isotope ratios will be different. If we get some stuff that's been floating around in space, some cosmic dust that's out there, those actually make a big difference. If you take a look at the little graph that I put up on Open Minds that I let them publish, and that should have been peer-reviewed before it went out there, but you'll notice that there's a chondrite meteorite, and it doesn't fall on that line. That's because it's not from Earth. It actually came from space. So that is those isotope ratios are real important, and we measure them. We've got some really sophisticated equipment that's out there. There's one that's looked at that's kind of cool, which is an aluminum isotope. What happens is when meteorites are floating around through space and cosmic rays run into the element of aluminum, it actually changes its isotope ratios, and we can measure that and tell something about the age of the meteorite and how long it's been floating around space.
Mm.
So there's all of this stuff is measured in thousandths and ten thousandths of a percent, as opposed to tens, which are tens of a percent, which is what I've got.
Okay.
On this stuff.
Are you able to name the laboratory?
You did your research well.
Right. Are you able to name the laboratory that did the testing?
I don't mind naming them. It was kind of a mistake, but the name of the lab that did the work was Evans Analytical. And they are a top-notch lab. In fact, I didn't know it. This is actually the first time I've actually mentioned their name, but anybody that looks at that and does a little bit of work can probably figure out where the work was done at.
Are you able to name the scientists involved? I mean, there's the other half. Are you able to name the analysts that were involved in that?
I don't even remember their names. I'd have to go back and look it up in my my email on that. But
so they're not concerned with not being named or anything like that?
You know, I don't know. I think it'd be pretty easy for people to figure out who did it once they there's a little thing that says Shiva. If you take a look, it'll say Shiva number on it. If you go up and put in Shiva Labs, you'll come up with Evans Analytical.
Okay.
It's they're the same people. Interesting thing is that when I had this work done, when the work was done by those folks, within a few days doing some more research, I had found out that it was the Evans and Associates, before they became Evans Analytical, that actually did the work for Peter Sturrock in the work on the Ubatuba UFO, and they did some excellent isotopic work on that.
Okay.
If you go and pull up Peter Sturrock's report on the Ubatuba UFO and you look and see the isotope ratios, you'll notice the same chart, because I actually borrowed his chart, and it was Evans that actually did the work on the Ubatuba, and it was, they had it down to thousandths of a percent, and they did some fantastic work for Peter Sturrock when he did the work on that UFO fragment.
Has that lab report been made public at all?
What, that one on the Ubatuba?
No, on your own.
It's out there. I think Open Minds published it.
Okay.
I think they have the report that's on their website.
Okay, great. So what is the next step that you need to take here to take this to the next level?
Well, the next level on this is to basically get another lab or a really, really good university to run another isotope analysis on this material. The hard part about this, I'm a school teacher, so all these analysis cost, and it hasn't cost me anything yet, but it takes a lot of time to get it set up. Now that the word is out in reference to this stuff, there's people that kind of balk at it. The big universities, a lot of them will not look at the material at all because they are afraid it might taint their
yeah.
science or whatever,
sure.
Fringe science. And then what happens is material has a tendency to disappear. So now I'm at the point where if I'm going to have a lab look at this, I want to be there and hand deliver it. Basically is what I want to do. And so that is all in the works right now. I know that I originally told people several weeks ago that it was going to be a few weeks. We're going to get, and I'm not going to hide anything from anybody. I will I will certainly let the world know, let the UFO community know exactly what this is. Yeah, it was funny because there was a panel discussion where there was Tom Schmidt, Tom Carey, or Don Schmidt, Tom Carey, Stanton Friedman, Kevin Randall, and myself as a new researcher, and people were asking questions during the panel at the UFO Festival, and they wanted me to talk, and I got to talking about getting this isotopic work done, and I mentioned the same thing that I mentioned on your show, that I said this material is either you know, a piece of an alien spacecraft, or I says, or it's it could be Mr. Rancher's beer can too. And
right.
The only way we're going to do this is to get more analytical work done on it. Kevin Randall kind of leaned over to me and he said, "What if it's an alien beer can?"
Well, yeah, there's
and
that.
I laughed at it. I thought it was really funny. And that's the state of this. You know, I'm trying to follow good science on this. And yeah, I've made a couple little mistakes here and there and things on this, but and the media sensationalism has gotten out of control on this, which is, you know, they do that to sell magazines and make movies and stuff. The only thing I want done on this is some good science. I want to be able to say, yes, this material is from another world, or I want to be able to come back and say, I'm sorry, guys, this is an aluminum can. But see, that also poses some questions. If it's an aluminum can, how did it get shredded up into the stuff that looks like confetti? Mm-hmm. And thrown over a large area. Then the other thing is about the buttons. How did the buttons get out there? Because there's mm-hmm. a bunch of questions that will have to be asked. You know, you said you did that you have done some metal detecting before. Have you ever found little shredded up pieces of aluminum can that's folded over about 52 times? Have you ever found any of that?
It's funny that you asked that. I live in Maryland, so I have a house on the beach as well that I go down pretty much every other weekend, and I'm messing around on the beach with a metal detector. And every once in a while, I will find some absurd little piece of metal that, I got to be honest, doesn't look a whole lot different from what, you know, visually, of course, doesn't look a whole lot different from what you're finding out there. What that is down to, I haven't a clue. There's usually things I throw in the garbage can at the top of the hill. I look at that and I go, if it is a beer can, how would it get shredded? I don't know. You've got serious winds that can happen in the desert environment like that. And certainly, if you've
and
got
I
something,
agree with that 100%.
Yeah, something so like a tin can blowing around in the desert, I would think would be kind of akin to a stone being washed by a river, where, you know, the jagged rocks act like a belt sander and essentially over time, I guess, could shred something up. I don't know that, because I'm looking at this picture, which is another thing I wanted to ask you about, is the AH1 fragment under magnification shows banded or layered structures.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know that I've seen anything like that. I don't know that I've looked all that close.
Neither have I, and that was one of the things I've had a few metallurgy kind of speculations on this, but I would like a good material scientist metallurgist to take a look at this and look at the pictures and try to figure out what the heck those are. But it does. The material does have, when you look at it, it does appear banded or layered, and the layers are micron thick, and I'm going, what in the world is this? Because I've looked at a lot of pictures of microstructures of aluminum, and there's some lines that you get from rolling. They're called rolling roller mill lines, but
right.
These are not roller mill lines, because that one picture is kind of an oblong thing that sits in the middle, and it's layered. It has got layers that are micron thick, and I'm going, what is this stuff? So that's one of the things, one of the anomalies that's in this, is that it certainly does look, for all intents and purposes, like there's some layering in it.
No magnetic properties to this at all?
No, there's no magic properties. It's not magnetic. I try to tell people, there's some people out there that say, well, does it do anything in an electrostatic field? And I always laugh when I see that, because I've seen some tests of some other claims where people say, well, I've got this UFO material, you know, it flies around in an electrostatic field. And I'm going, well, yeah, so does pieces of paper, aluminum foil, hair,
tin foil, right, yeah.
just about anything will fly around in an electrostatic field, and it does the same thing with a Tesla coil. So anytime somebody puts a little piece of metal on top of a Tesla coil and have it dance or move around, I'm going, that doesn't prove anything. I says, I'm telling these people that if you take a piece of this metal and you hook up some electrodes to it and you run it through some frequency counters and the thing starts glowing blue and then levitates, then you've got something.
Right. Yeah. 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 Or eats you and then you've got a problem. Well, I mean, I'm glad to see that, that you're approaching it the way you are. I got to be honest. Because, you know, there's been so many people over the years that, you know, have claimed anomalous material. There's been all sorts of, I mean, there's been parts before that have been claimed to have been Roswell in origin. And these things, the last you hear from them are, we're getting them analyzed. And then you don't hear anything. And so I'm glad that you're taking this step by step to do it right.
Now, it might take me. I originally told everybody I was going to have this done in the next few weeks. Being a school teacher, school's getting ready to start here, and I'm going to get bogged down doing school stuff and things. And I'm trying really hard not to let this interfere with my work whatsoever. Matter of fact, I haven't heard anything from the people I work with. I haven't gone in there and seen all of them yet. I'm just waiting to hear back from them.
Yeah, I was going to ask you what the school's reaction to all this has been.
I haven't heard anything from them. They might ignore it, or they might nonchalantly call me over to the side and ask me some questions about it. I'm a scientist, and they know that, and they also know that I'm a good teacher, and I'm going to follow the scientific method, and I'm not going to embarrass the school or myself. You know, I will be the first to come out and say, guys, this is an aluminum can, or guys, this is a piece of an actual spacecraft, and that's the way it is. I'll be sad if it comes out to be a can or some common thing, but you know what? Then it goes into just part of the story. We've got to be able to explain how it got out there, why it's out there, and why it's in the form that it's in, why does it have the little layers in it, and then we got to get to the buttons and figure out, you know, why are the buttons out there? So there's a lot more to this story than just you know, analysis stuff.
Sure.
It's part of the history of this whole Roswell thing.
Well, in the end, and no matter what it ends up being, you're out there actively trying to do something, actively trying to find something, and I think that even if it comes up to be your standard beer can or what have you, I think it's still to your credit to say you were out there doing something, which, you know, there's not a whole lot of people out there walking around in that kind of environment for 5 and 6 hours at a time swinging a metal detector around looking for this. I don't imagine so.
Yeah, I'm not done with the research part. I've got plans on finding the original crash site, which I don't think anyone's found. There's been some people that say they found it, but I've got this whole thing has been kind of interesting because I've gotten some leads on some things which are really, really good that I have every intent of following up on You know, I haven't started to write any books yet or anything like that. But when this is all over with, I think it's going to make an interesting book because I've run into some interesting people, some flaky people, some strange people that are out there.
No doubt.
I'd like to call them. I won't mention any names. I've run into some. I call them spin masters, people that take the UFO and stories and they spin it around and they use it to basically promote themselves and to make money with. And there's people that are out there that they would be proud. I think P.T. Barnum would be very proud of them. It's sucker born every minute. And believe me, I'm when I get ready to sit down and write a book, it's going to be a good one. In fact, I may title it The Spin Masters. I don't know. I mean,
there you go. Well, I mean, in the end here, for whatever this turns out to be, I guess the question that probably everyone is going to want me to ask, because it's happened to me, so I'm going to ask you, at any point during the looking for this material, the analysis of this material, you having it alone in your possession, has anyone come up to you and either leveled some kind of threat at you? Has anyone tried to scare you off of it? Phone calls, any sort of thing like that at all?
Well, here's what I've gotten. I got an email that basically said, don't trust anyone, not even me. And it's somebody that I had been communicating with a little bit. I received another email that basically said, they mentioned a large corporation. And matter of fact, I mentioned their name earlier in the show. I won't mention them in reference to this because I don't want to get myself in trouble, but this large corporation that has an interest in UFO phenomena thing, basically, what I heard was that if they said, Frank, if they prove that this stuff is extraterrestrial in origin, or if they suspect it, they're going to do everything in their power to get it from you. And that means they're going to follow you around. They're going to break into your house. They're going to do all this. But I've had no physical threats whatsoever from anyone. I've kind of protected myself a little bit on this. I've got the materials in multiple locations and multiple vaults. I've left instructions with people to do things if something worse, crazy stuff. You know, if you're paranoid, right. If something happens to me, do this with the material. The stuff that I have is well protected, and there was a weird thing that happened that I think was nothing more than coincidence. My family and I were sitting and we were watching a movie in our little thing that we call the media room, and the dog barked, and I looked out, and I'm going, and my son looked out the door into the living room, and it was pitch black, and I'm going, holy smokes, that's a laser. And there was a laser sight dancing around inside the room. I'm going, well, and I shut off all the lights in the house, and then the light went out, and I went out the front door, and I looked around, and I looked out I saw the neighbor kids playing with like plastic like rifles out there, but I didn't see any of them have a laser sight on. Then I got to thinking about what direction it came from, and it had to have come in through my back door from the field across the street. And I mean, the kids couldn't have done it in the front. But other than that, I've had absolutely nothing happen whatsoever, and I'm really not expecting anything. I might expect something if it comes out and they actually say, this is a piece of extraterrestrial metal, then I might have something happen.
I wonder how you would separate this. If it turns, just say, for instance, you get this analyzed and they say, it's not from here. Then what would be the ultimate differentiation between that versus a meteorite? I mean, I own plenty of samples of meteorite, and you look at some of these things, even in their natural state, a cross-section of these things with a little bit of acid etch, and they look like they're manufactured. I mean, they look like they're layered pieces. They're beautiful things. What would then differentiate this from a meteoric piece?
I've had a couple of people ask me that question. For one thing, aluminum is not naturally occurring. It's one of those elements that combines with oxygen really fast, kind of like iron. So you end up with iron oxide, or aluminum oxide, should I say? And that's what we mine on the planet. There's no such thing as, we have some native elements like native copper, native gold, and we find that in its raw form. But there is no such thing on Earth as native aluminum because it's too reactive with our atmosphere and the water and everything that's around us. If the material were to come back as being having an extraterrestrial signature, and we get it confirmed a couple of times that it actually is an extraterrestrial signature, then what it implies is that we have an alloy. We have a piece of metal that's manufactured by intelligent living things someplace else. And that would be earth-shattering. That would be... I don't even know. I would have to I don't know what I'd do other than to stand there and just kind of look at it, hold a piece of it in my hand and stare at it in awe, saying,
yeah.
Oh my gosh, I've got something from another world in my hand, manufactured by something other than Earth, the people on Earth. I mean, it's manufactured someplace else. That would be pretty, it would be a pretty startling discovery. Startling.
Absolutely. Jeremy, you got anything here?
Yeah, a couple.
Okay, fire away.
Not a lot, because Jeff has done such a thorough job, and I'm completely useless when it comes to analysis type work. I'm good at theorizing about nonsense, but I can't really, you know, when it comes to actually thinking, that becomes a problem. But here's a question that's been brewing the whole time I've been listening, is we had on a man named Wes Owsley, who's sort of our, I guess, NASA correspondent, I guess we could call him.
Sure.
But he had done some looking into Dr. Roger Lear has these alleged alien implants, you know, that he pulls out of people's bodies.
Yep, I am familiar with the Lear.
Meteoric material that give off radio frequencies and things like that, and so therefore it can't possibly be from here or naturally occurring in the body. But what Wes has found is that there's a thing called an ion channelopathy that actually produces that in the body, produces pieces of, well, I guess balls of what look like iron not known, it would look like meteorite, essentially. It would be something that's not known because it's an amalgamation of different types of iron that
okay.
sort of congeal together in the body. And so it would come up as meteorite. It would come up as something similar to or exactly that. If you were to pull it out and examine it. So I'm wondering, is there, you know, when we say it's got to be from here or, you know, under pedestrian terms, or it's got to be alien, is there, could there not be something like that where we're just missing some little in-between thing that's not commonly known but isn't from another planet?
Yeah, I can speculate about this myself. You know, I had somebody ask me if somebody could fake this, and I'm going, not unless you've got some tremendously deep pockets and you wanted to throw around shredded up stuff that you've spent a few zillion dollars on laying out in the desert and hope the hell somebody's going to find it in a remote place. I don't know.
You don't know what you don't know. But I mean, have you looked into just, you know, as you guys were talking about what the desert winds do to metal? I mean, have you looked into that, just what would happen for any sort of common
thing? Yeah, and, you know, here in this particular area, the wind does blow quite a bit, and there is always that possibility that this material could be man-made and could have blown in from someplace.
I mean, even with the sun sort of reacting, like if it was, say, just a Coke can, right, and whatever ingredients that go into Coca-Cola get sun-baked into the metal, and then that metal, you know, gets tossed around. I mean, all of that, does it chemically do something to the metal to make it come out different than Coke can?
No, well, I mean, as far as the chemistry of the metal is going to, it's not going to do anything to that, not at all. That much I do know, just the basic chemistry on that. You know, I've been to, I was invited out with some people to Horse Springs to look at the plains of San Augustine UFO crash site, and that's actually the town dump for Horse Springs. And I saw thousands of aluminum cans out there from just about every time period, including the ones with aluminum tops and iron bodies, which was some of the first ones that came out. And walking around out there, I didn't see any shredded aluminum cans and the stuff that was, I didn't find any flip-tops laying on the surface or anything like that. You know, things can blow around, and that's a distinct possibility. But I don't know if you've ever been out to the or seen the Roswell debris field. The road is 2 miles away. There is a pumping station that is about a mile and a quarter away, which is a pipeline pumping station. And, you know, I've thought about, you know, could this be trash from the pumping station? Could it be trash from the road? I've thrown around a lot of things. And, you know, the only way that you can really tell is to do all this analysis and have people look at it and determine whether it's a piece of trash or whether it's something else. And that's what I was trying to do on this stuff.
If it comes back, if you send it out to different labs and it still comes back inconclusive, what will you do next?
You know, the word inconclusive, you know, there's always that possibility that it would come back as I'm hoping that it won't. The people that I'm going to have look at this next route, I'm going to try to have some of the best people in the world look at it and determine exactly what it is. And my request to them was that the accuracy be really, really good, the precision be really, really good, and we got to get numbers that will stand up to scientific scrutiny. And that's the criteria that I've got on this. And you know, I'm going to keep going. I'm not going to give up until I get an answer. It either is or it isn't, and that's what I want to know. And I'll keep testing it till I run out of material, until I get an answer.
And Jeff had asked you, you know, had you been warned off by people or had any sort of thing like that? Have you had anything amp up in your life, paranormally speaking, since going about this?
No, not at all. You know, nothing that I would consider abnormal at all. And I've got a pretty open mind, and I understand a lot of things that are out there, and everything from the weird and esoteric all the way up to the most scientific stuff. So you got to take it all in. If you've got a mind that where you're asking why all the time, and you want to explore the world, you have to have a pretty good open mind. But I haven't had anything. Strange or odd to happen whatsoever, at least not yet.
Do you think you would have been onto this at all had you not had a UFO sighting way back when?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, everybody takes an interesting path, you know, that certainly intrigued me. You know, even at a young age, I was like building Tesla coils, and I was playing with all kinds of electronic things, because I really like the Tesla coils are kind of fascinating to play with. So I kind of like that stuff. And you know what? I probably would have done this even without that. You know, that was kind of that sighting that I had when I was traveling cross country. The only one I've ever had where that there was something odd. I haven't seen anything that I couldn't explain. I don't think it would have made a difference. I probably still would have done this. It's just me, the way that I am, because I'm one of these scientists that likes to get answers to things, and I'm not going to stop until I get an answer. And you know, come good or come bad, I'm going to get it. And that's the way I am. I like to dig this stuff out and find out what's going on. I don't like secrets. That's the Roswell thing bugs me. I don't like secrets.
Well, let me ask you about just the town of Roswell. I know this is completely off topic, but how do they take all of this? I mean, are they divided about this type of publicity? Do they welcome it? What do they make of being Roswell?
You know,
like in New York, if you're a New Yorker, you're not going to go to the Empire State Building or the Statue of Liberty or any of that, and you're going to hate tourists.
Oh, and you know what? They do the same thing here. If you take the locals, they don't even visit the UFO Museum. The only people that go into the UFO Museum here are the tourists that come into the town, and there's also a small handful of local researchers that I've actually gotten to know. Some of them are a little odd. Some of them are really very intelligent, very nice, and I've run into a few of those people in the UFO Museum as well. But that's right. You get the group that's oblivious to it, and those people that live here and work here—it's part of their everyday life. And you know, it's kind of like living next to Carlsbad Caverns. If you go to Carlsbad Caverns once or twice, you don't need to go to it like every single day, kind of thing. So Roswell's kind of inbred for the community here, and the people know about it, not a lot of people. This story hasn't really hit mainstream at all. The local newspapers haven't picked it up. I haven't heard anything from them. The local media hasn't touched on it. The paparazzi hasn't knocked at my door. The only people that know about this are people like you folks, and open minds, the people that go out and peruse the internet, the people that have visited the, you know, the UFO Museum doesn't like display it up all over the place, and you know, they let me do a talk on it, and It was really funny because I was such a new person. I said, you know, they put up a little display. The very first talk I gave, I had two people show up to the talk. And then after I gave the lecture at night with Kevin Randall and Don Schmidt, Tom Carey, and those people, the next day I had pretty much I had about 20 people show up in the audience. But I'm a newbie to this, and a lot of people even here in town, you know, they small town, they know I'm a teacher. But a lot of people that live here know that I teach at NEMI, and they, you know, like I said, they haven't said anything, and the people look at it as part of the mystique of Roswell, I guess.
Well, it's interesting too, just to think about that. There must have been a point when the old timers, the alleged witnesses, and all of that would have these coffee shop talks about their experiences, you know, because certainly these people were going on TV and all of that. So there must have been that sort of sense of community around this at some point, right? And then the story just continues on and on with no resolution. Does that affect a community at all, or does everyone just take it in stride?
I think they just take it in stride. You know,
Do you even talk to witnesses anymore? Or are they just like, yeah, the thing I saw back in 40, my dad saw, you know, back in 47?
A lot of them are dead. A vast majority of the primary witnesses are the main witness, people that actually saw this, are dead. Their kids and grandkids are around, and you know, if you happen to mention it, they'll talk to you about it. I've talked with you know, she's still alive as far as I know. Of course, I haven't seen her in a while, and that's Frankie Rowe. She's one of the few people that's actually handled the material when she was very, very young. And then you know, I've spoke to like the grandkids of some of the people that are directly that saw the you know, it went down on their ranch or whatever. So yeah, if you catch them and they know about it, they'll talk to you about it, and they'll talk to you freely about it. So there's a few of them around. They're just few and far between. You know, I met one of the Corns, because the Corn Ranch, it's part of the McKnights and the Corns and a couple of other ranches around where this thing was supposed to have crashed. And I spoke to the Corns and I met one of the other Corns that owns the other ranch on the other end of town. He says, oh, you need to talk to my brother. He knows all about the crash, because it was out at our other ranch where it was supposed to have come down. So yeah, the people will talk to you if you ask them about it.
There are all these sort of divergent stories about Roswell. If you go to Roswell, is there one particular where the locals will say, yeah, that's what happened, not this other crap?
You know, the ones that the people that live here follow the Mac Brazel story pretty much. The people say, hey, something crashed out there. They do not believe the balloon story. They certainly believe that a craft of some kind came down out there. They know for a fact that Mac Brazel found some pretty bizarre material laying around on the ranch side. The people that live here know for a fact that the military hushed it up, and they don't and most of them that are here don't believe the hocus pocus. They believe in the story as the hardcore part of it. You know, Mac Brazel finds this, government hides it. That's the story that these folks believe in.
And I guess my last question is, if it comes back that this has some terrestrial origin to it, what's next for you? Do you stick around in UFO world?
Oh, you know what? This has gotten to be a lot of fun. It really has. And no, I will. I think tracking down, doing work on trace evidence of UFOs is something that needs to be done. You know, you can. There's got to be some proof out there someplace in the world. And by golly, if I had a nice philanthropist out there with some really deep pockets, I would certainly, you know, I'd probably travel all over the world and I would seek out like religiously, and I would nail this UFO thing like I'd go after it. I mean, vigorously, because it's a there's doesn't seem to be a lot of people that do that, and there's not a lot of time and effort involved in it. You know, some little mom and pop things here and there, and there's a few little, you know, old researchers that kind of dabble in it a little bit. But as far as somebody that goes after this wholeheartedly, I know Bigelow has, Robert Bigelow's got some interest in this, but you know what? If I had his resources and his money, I would chase this stuff to the ends of the earth, because it would be fun. It's kind of like an Indiana Jones thing, like the Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Well, that's true. But say you don't get a philanthropist. I mean, would you continue doing speaking engagements and things like that?
You know what? Yeah, you know, I don't mind. I'll talk about this. Absolutely. You know, there is a difference between good science and bad science, and I'm not going to I'll talk about this. Absolutely. Come, you know, if it comes back an aluminum can, if it comes back a piece of an extraterrestrial spacecraft, no matter what happens on this, I certainly don't mind talking about it, and especially the part where how difficult it is to actually get good work done. When people hear the word UFO, they kind of like, they say, oh, just like the guy at the University of New Mexico that said, this is a bunch of hooey. You get a lot of that out there, and you need to have, I think we have lost, the scientific world so much has lost that curiosity factor that we used to have back in like the 1800s or turn of the century. There's very few scientists that are curious. These days, everything is peer-reviewed. Nobody wants to stick their necks out. So to answer your question, yeah, you know what? I'll give talks. I'll continue with this. I haven't given up in the UFO world at all. I'll talk about this for probably years to come.
Well, Frank, thank you so much for doing the show and giving us so much of your time. It's much appreciated.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Well, you guys are I'll have to say this, that you all asked some really good, very pointed questions. Probably you guys are good, you know, for your interviews. So you did some excellent work on this.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thanks.
I'll take all the credit.
Great.
Thank you again, Frank Kimbler. I know you said you have a website. It's not related to any of this. I feel like we should plug something for you here.
Oh, you know what? I've got an interesting hobby. I collect and sell radioactive mineral specimens. And
Jesus!
Oh, wonderful! Yeah,
there's our next show. Fantastic.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting little hobby, and you'd be surprised how many people actually buy these things and how many collectors there are out there that want to buy a piece of uranium ore. It's kind of wild. But it's atomicrocks.com is actually my website, and that one deals with radioactive collecting of minerals. So that's, and there's nothing out there about UFOs whatsoever.
So in addition to collecting Roswell metal, Frank sells cancer. So please visit his website.
Oh, no, not at all. Don't, absolutely not. I love that. Everybody, anytime you mention the word radioactive, everybody thinks about cancer. But you know what? You can go and stand in the sunshine for, it depends upon the body and what you do, and the amount of radioactivity that's in a rock is not enough to kill you unless you you know, grind it up into little pieces and eat it for breakfast or snort it or something. I've been doing this for a long time. I'm not dead yet, and I don't expect to be. It's just mineral collecting is like the second or third largest hobby in the world, and this just happens to be an offshoot of mineral collecting. It's really all it is.
Sounds pretty cool to me, and I bet you'll get a ton of hits.
Yeah, well, you'd be surprised at the number of there's lots of museums that have radioactive specimens. I was over at one of the local government offices here in town, and they've got some really. I'm looking at the labels on these, and I'm going, "Yeehaw!" That's right at eye level, and it's some really fairly radioactive rocks they got sitting in a display case. I did go over to Knott's Berry Farm many years ago. They asked me to come over and take a look because they got a complaint from they actually moved a piece of uranium ore that I determined that was not exactly the perfect thing to have on display. It was about the size of a football, and it was pure pitch blend. And from a radioactive side, I'd have to say that it was hotter than a firecracker and really didn't need to be on display. It needed to be off in a back room someplace.
Wow. Neat. That's all I can say.
Neat hobby you got there.
Yeah. Oh, well, Frank, once again, thank you for doing this, and we look forward to hearing the results whenever you can make this happen.
I will keep you all posted, and the analytical side of this is sort of kind of in negotiation. I got a couple of things coming from a bunch of different directions. One of the TV show people contacted me and basically said, you know, can you hold off on getting the analysis done because we might want to make it part of our show, and I'm still waiting to hear back because they said they would pay for it. So, and I can't mention as to which show it is, but it's one that everybody watches. So I was waiting to hear back from them, and then there's a few other things. I'm trying to get this work done for free without having to fork out a bunch of money, because kind of analysis, these are averaging anywhere between $500 to $1,000 a piece, and the next one is going to be right in that $1,000 to $2,000 range to have it done, so it gets to be kind of expensive.
Yeah.
Hmm. All right, sir. Thank you for your time.
You are welcome.
Yes.
And again, we look forward to hearing about it.
I will keep you guys posted. I'll let everybody know what's going on with the material.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me on your show. I appreciate it very much.
This is Jason Offit, author of Darkness Walks, The Shadow People Among Us, and you're listening to Paratopia.
So the Jeff.
So the Jer. A little late for us, isn't it?
A little late?
It's a little.
In the evening, you mean?
That's correct, yes.
Yes, it is a little late for us, doesn't matter.
We're a little punchy, a little tired.
Yes, it's about midnight on the night, on the eve of the show.
I love doing this.
Yeah, nothing like coming at you a day late and a dollar short. Before we get into our thoughts on this, when we stopped recording, you had read him a question that Dr. Kochjohn, our good friend at Tyler, had for him, and I clicked record just in time to get his answer, and of course he knows that I recorded it, and he said it's fine that I post his answer to Tyler. But why don't you read Tyler's question, because I didn't catch that part, and then I'll just launch into the answer.
Well, Tyler's question, I think, was, I'm going to have to find it now. He caught me
off
guard.
Don't think. Read.
I can't find it. Okay, here we go. Well, this had to do with essentially Dr. Strzok's graph that is pictured there. He says, my instincts tell me that this is not valid. You have numbers not so different from terrestrial samples, and when you proceed to calculate the ratios and plot them on Sturck's graph, suddenly the values are way off the line. Essentially, he asks, is it valid to just pile on the Roswell sample, assessed a decade or so later by a different team and different equipment, onto that Sturck graph?
And here's his answer.
The fractionation graph, and that's a legitimate question. The fractionation graph is something that you could, you know, if you had the equipment for, if you had equipment that could do it from the 1800s, no matter what you're going to have. The only thing I did was I took that fractionation graph that Peter Sturck had, and I expanded it. I made it longer, and then I went out on the internet and I plotted various things in addition to what Peter Sturck did. Peter Sturck took basically Dow chemical samples of, they use standards plus the Ubatuba, and I left the Ubatuba thing off. But because the Yuba Tuba plotted right on the line too, which basically proved that the Yuba Tuba metallic sample was of earthly origin, not extraterrestrial. That actually plotted almost in the middle. And then what I did was I went out and I added a bunch of things to that. I added a chondrite meteorite. I added seawater. I added different types of minerals and rocks to that just to see where they would plot on that line. Because the point that I was trying to make on that was the fact that if it's an earthly origin thing, it will plot somewhere on or very, very near that line. And then I plotted the meteorite, and it plots off the line, and then I plotted the AH1. AH1 plotted really significantly off the line, and the only reason why it did is because two of the isotopes were way at the outer margin of the analytical error. Yeah, and I've gotten a couple of this, but really, really, and you said that the guy that sent this worked at the, was a professor at the
Arizona College of Osteopathic Medicine.
And his interpretation on that is really good.
So, all right, there you go. So what do you make of all of this? Is it, what's your spidey sense on this? Going to end up being nothing, going to end up being something? And what was it before the interview? Let's put it that way. What did you think going into the interview, and what do you think now?
Well, I'm always interested in hard data. I mean, who wouldn't be? I think if this had been, it wouldn't have mattered if it was Roswell or Gulf Breeze or Pine Bush or wherever. Some kind of interesting thing found at the site of an unusual event interests me. So I was kind of like, it's Roswell. But, you know, has anybody really gone out and done wide sweeps of that desert out there to actually try and find something? And this guy seems to really be into it. And seeing as he teaches earth science and geology, I thought this could be good. So I don't know that he's done a lot of interviews so far. So I kind of jumped on him quick, and we got him in for this week, which was great. And we appreciate him coming in kind of last minute. What did I think? I think I wouldn't be at all surprised if in the end it turns out that these are trash, that they are beer cans or Coke cans or what have you that have been tumbled around like a rock in a rock tumbler for God knows how many years. And whatever elements that they've picked up have been picked up essentially from being out in the elements and from doing that tumble across the desert. That wouldn't surprise me. As you point out towards the end of the interview there, what things or what elements or what artifacts can be created just by being out in the elements and being exposed to the ground, to the air, to pollution, to God knows what else? That's a big question to me. Like, what does that do? And that's why I said the buttons in this case would be a great control sample, because if, in fact, they've been there as long as the debris has, and that's a big if, we don't know that they're even connected. But going off this standard lore, let's just say they are. If that's the case, they've been out there at least as long as the material samples that he's collecting. And so to use those as kind of like control analysis would be great, because they're being exposed to the same elements. And so I think that would really behoove him to kind of run those through the same analysis.
Can you run buttons that are plastic through the same analysis as metal?
Well, actually, they're aluminum buttons.
Oh, they're aluminum. I'm sorry.
Yeah, there's some kind of aluminum.
Am I not listening?
Right. And like I say, you know, they've been out there at least as long. So I would be curious. And I would also be curious to see what would happen if you did a blind sample. I understand what he's saying about the standard samples. But they would be, I'm guessing, decidedly different in appearance from what he's submitting for analysis. I'm talking about making something that would essentially be an aluminum replica of some sort. Like, take some beer cans, set them on fire, leave them out for the next, I don't know, 6 months, and then bash the hell out of them with a maul till they're flat, fold them over a couple of times and smack them with a maul again. Just keep doing that. Try to make yourself something that looks like a reasonable facsimile of the actual sample that you're taking. Make sure that they are in control bags, that they are labeled, that they are stringently run that way. And then you're holding the key to what the analysis shows. So in the end, well, here's my beer can and here's my Roswell sample. And so A is this and B is that. And now how do A and B analyze? What's the differences? How are they different? How are they similar? Are they exactly the same? I mean, that too came from kind of a I guess I kind of took Tyler's idea and kind of bastardized it a little bit, but that's the idea. Just to provide. I mean, you do that pretty much, or I like to think that most field researchers know if you go out and you find a landing site that you not only gather samples from inside an affected area, but also outside an affected area. When you do crop circle research, you collect samples from inside and you collect a mass of control samples from outside at varying distances from the actual event. So I see no reason to do anything different here.
Me neither.
Right.
How dare you laugh at me? I don't see a reason not to do things that you think we should do.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I mean, I look forward to having Frank back on. I told him after the show was recorded that I would flip him an email in a couple of months and see what had been done or what hadn't been done. There seems to be some things on the horizon for him, so let's give him a little time and see what he can figure out. And with any luck, we'll have him back on the show to talk about the results of the next wave of testing. And he certainly seemed open to that. So at this point, it's a wait and see. I mean, it could go either way.
Yeah, I'm hoping it doesn't turn into the, you know, Lloyd Pye, let's just wait until somebody tells me what I want to hear.
Kind of. Yeah, I don't know. I don't get that sense from him. I don't know the man, but I don't get that sense.
No, I don't either. I mean, I was actually, I guess I'm just so prejudiced toward my own people, this yeah. field, I expected perhaps a train wreck or something. But no, he seemed completely sensible and knowledgeable.
Which is refreshing, yeah.
Yeah, which is really refreshing. So I actually hope he gets his wish and some philanthropist gives him some free money and he gets to go around the world bring us with him. That'd be great.
Yeah, well, yeah. And the other part that I thought was nice was that he said he was having a lot of fun in this UFO thing. And my only reaction to that is, you haven't been around long enough.
Yeah, just ye wait.
Well, anyway, shall we bid adieu, my friend?
Let us leaf, said the tree. Paratopia, we out. We'll see you next week.
Good night, all.
And don't forget to catch us live this Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time and every Sunday thereafter at the ParaQuest Radio Network. That's ParaQuestRadioNetwork.com. 9 p.m. Sundays, live, call in, chat with us. That's where we'll be. Ciao for now.